Welcome, everyone, to About Being Alive. I'm Jordan.
And I'm Jason.
And we are really excited to be here and chat with you about positive psych, about life, and really about being able to manifest the reality of your choosing and digging into what that looks like and how to get there.
It's a long time coming. We're all ready to get started and to share some extremely insightful thoughts that we've been having for many years, and many maybe not insightful thoughts that we can test out.
All thoughts welcome.
All thoughts are welcome, and no judgment as we explore this realm. I'm really excited and honored to be here with you, man.
Yeah, likewise, man. Likewise. So we're here at CGU, Claremont Graduate University, and we are studying positive psychology. I will be entering into my first year of the PhD, and Jason's a veteran. How long have you been here?
Fifth year student here at Claremont, heading into my, closing my third year PhD, actually.
And just so you know how it works, 5 years in grad school, it's kind of like dog years. So that's equivalent to about 15 years of life, condensed into five. And Jason, I've learned a lot. He's really helped me along this process and is a wealth of information. You want to talk a little bit about what your focus is and what your passion here?
Yeah, so I came in here wanting to study positive psychology. That's what drove me here. We'll dig a little deeper into what that is exactly. And my focus here at Claremont Graduate is studying leadership development in the workplace through the lens of how can we help leaders operate the best way that they can so that the business can thrive, not just financially, but that it can be a microcosm of a very healthy culture that can ultimately spread into every employee's lives and make it more meaningful. And so I look into the question of how do leaders' qualities of attention affect the way they interact with their followers? And I study how mindfulness can be a tool for leaders to not only help themselves perform the best and have good well-being, but actually a leader's mindfulness impacts the way that they relate to their follower and their followers develop.
So I'd love for you to dig down more into mindfulness, because that's sort of a buzzword that's been humming now for the past decade or so. What drew you to mindfulness, and what's been your personal experience in your own practice?
I grew up playing so many computer games while watching TV shows, while eating Cheetos and sipping on Coca-Cola. Fantastic. So I was getting all sorts of high stimulation at one time as a kid. And it was so fun and engaging and chat. And to be able to explore that area was just so much in stimulation that it eventually drowned my development out a little bit, because I needed that stimulation for things to work perfectly.
Yeah.
What got me into mindfulness was in college. I started taking some yoga classes here and there. I've always been a fan of exercise. And so going into yoga class, they started talking about grounding in, feeling the movement, putting your mind onto it. Never thought of it that way. Mm. And I started to notice how my academic performance changed. Mm. My interests in life changed. How I interact with the people that I liked and people that I love changed just through the way that my quality of mind differed. Mm-hmm. And then I explored the topic more. And when I was studying abroad over in Denmark, I did a big project on mindfulness as it's somewhat connected to the positive psychology realm. And I became in love with this idea of training it just like training a muscle.
Mm-hmm.
Playing sports all my life, that metaphor was so easy to grasp, because it is a muscle. The mind is a muscle, and I never thought of it that way. The more I practiced, started off with just doing headspace for a few minutes every day, to eventually I've gone on some silent retreats. I noticed a huge difference in the way that my mind operates.
Wow. So you really experienced, and I think, first of all, I love the metaphor of a rep, like training, mm-hmm. and practicing mindfulness is kind of like is a rep. Like you have all these repetitions within a practice. In my own personal experience, that reframe really changed my own practice. And when you're practicing, being able to bring your attention back to, it could be your breath or a specific sensation or area in your body, whatever your point of focus is, to consider when your mind drifts, rather than, you know, resisting that or having self-judgment about your fluttering mind, being able to acknowledge that you're getting a rep, you know, just like you would a curl in the gym every time you're able to refocus your mind.
Yeah. And, you know, you can go to the gym and you can screw around.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, like, people will be doing all sorts of funny stuff there.
Yeah.
And the more I kind of sit down and have an intention at the gym, the mental gym, so to speak, oh man, my day just goes so much better. Yeah. Not to say I have perfect days.
Right.
Man, I have days where I get nothing done. You know, my eyes are glued to Instagram for 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And things just don't fit. There's a little cloud over my mind when that happens. And I don't like that feeling.
Yeah, nah, sunny skies here. Sunny skies all day, man. We're in SoCal. Have you ever meditated right after looking at Instagram?
Yes.
Yeah.
And I've had a lot of self-judgment over that. Because I'll you know, get home and then I'll kind of go on Instagram for a little bit, some social media, and then I'll be like, oh no, I should be practicing. What am I doing? I should be practicing.
Yeah.
So I sit down and my mind is just so like boom, 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 yeah. boom, boom, with all these random people showing up and thoughts. And then I'm suddenly struggling and struggling. Being okay with that, number one, is like the goal.
Yeah.
How can I just be okay with having a difficult practice? That's all my relationship with fear, my relationship with pain coming up. But also I would like to have a practice that's not as difficult as the post-Instagram workout.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's like training with a weight vest, you know? Like
yeah.
Heavy, maybe ankle weights too, throw them on there.
And if I can't do a push-up, I'm not putting on a heavy vest.
Yeah, yeah,
okay?
Right.
I'm firing that trainer who suggests that.
Yeah. In some of the mindfulness classes that I teach, I suggest as an experiment to practice, you know, waking up in the morning, starting your day with a meditation. And then at another point in your day, looking at Instagram for about 5 minutes, scrolling, and notice the change of your mind. Because I think that's in those moments where you're attempting to still or at least quiet your mind, that's when you're really able to notice the effects that that activity of scrolling really has on us that we're not really necessarily consciously aware of all the time. It's a fun and illuminating reality.
It's kind of like wakeboarding, where you're only staring at the sky while you're trying to wakeboard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're not even looking at the lake.
Yeah.
You're like, man, this is difficult.
Yeah.
What's
yeah.
going on?
Yeah.
This sucks.
Oh, there's a bump. Whoop. Didn't
Whoop,
see that
what
coming.
The heck?
Yeah.
And then what a mindfulness meditation practice will do is it'll make you look at the lake.
Yeah.
And stop wakeboarding for a second and look at the lake and you'll be like, whoa, it's kind of hard to swim out here.
Yeah.
What's going on? It's a little choppy.
A little choppy out here.
A little chop chop.
Yeah.
Over time, the lake will kind of quiet. And with that, makes wakeboarding a little easier. Now, I must make a disclaimer.
Yeah.
I've done wakeboarding a couple times.
Yeah.
I've never gotten up. And it's, you know what? It's a pretty frustrating thing of mine.
Yeah.
I hope one day I can overcome that challenge, that failure. I haven't gone in a long, long time. So anyone out there listening, like invite me to your lake house and help me overcome this traumatic life experience of not being able to wakeboard.
Yeah. Get him up on the board. A prize for anyone who can coach him in that process.
Let's talk a little about what drove you to do these classes and talk a little more about these classes that you're doing around at the Claremont Colleges.
Yeah, sure. So brief background. My background previously to enrolling here was athletics. So I played basketball my entire life. I played at Lehigh University in college, and then I went on to play after that overseas in Germany, France, Luxembourg, and Canada. And throughout my journey as an athlete, I really became aware of how important the mental game was. It was in high school where I came to this realization that, and it was really frustrating for me because one day I'd go out, I'd feel great, right? I just feel great. I drop 30, I'm feeling awesome. And the next day it's like 6. And my head, and the only thing to change, my skill set didn't change in that, you know, short time frame. But what it was my mental approach or something within my whether it was my self-belief or my ability to focus, something was going on. So that really drove me into psychology, into sports psychology, and that quickly led me to mindfulness and meditation. And then from there, I really went down the rabbit hole. So I started to get into different spiritual practices. Taoism was really intriguing to me, which led into some new age NLP. And so I really started to look at all these different modalities of how to enhance the human experience and what it means to be both a human being and a spiritual being. So after I got done playing, what I wanted to do is I wanted to study sort of these concepts in an academic setting and with the intention of being able to validate some of these experiences that I'd had both on the court and then in my own practices in psychological terms. And I think really what intrigued me most and what I'm here to really focus on is this idea of group flow. So when I found out that that the author of Flow, shout out, Csikszentmihalyi.
The great. And that I've definitely just butchered the pronunciation.
Yeah, I know. You went for it.
I went for a full.
You went for a full. I feel good about Csikszentmihalyi, but I don't know.
Known as Mike C on campus, apparently.
Yeah, Mike C. So I really was, once I found out that he was teaching, I was in. I wanted to learn from him and learn more about flow from an academic perspective. And to me, group flow is one of the best human experiences possible. That idea, and this could happen in a conversation, it could happen in an athletic environment, musicians, improv, you know, you name it. But it's that idea of when a group of people get together and they're looking to achieve a common goal, and there's just this merger that occurs where you lose sense of your own individuality. And that happens collectively, and you become this one force in a sense. And I think that there's so many positive emotions that come from that experience that I'm interested in how do we create that in, you know, more often in athletics because I love sports, but also the workplace and just in our daily lives. What can we do to organize ourselves so that we're able to have these really, you know, elating experiences more often?
I mean, the workplace is the place where we spend 70% of our lives nearly.
Yeah.
Our waking lives, we should say.
Mm-hmm.
It's an area that has potential for growth and meaning. So many people that we know of go in and out of work just working for the weekend.
Yeah.
And seeing it as a massive chore. I mean, can you imagine living your life where 70% of your waking life is just looked at, perceived as a chore? You don't need to live that way anymore. We have such a vast knowledge that can be applied to help people have the right state of mind to achieve things like group flow. And we've all experienced group flow.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be this high-performing like motocross experience. Conversation with a family member. It could be going out to dance with people and feeling this oneness orchestrating in a crowd. One thing that I love to experience is with an improv comedy.
Right.
So I've done improv about 4.5 years now. And as a group, we want our minds melded, so to speak.
Yeah.
And there's all these sorts of activities to do that.
Yeah. Well, can you explain that? Because I think that's a great example. There's a great book out, Group Genius, that is the author's name. I believe we'll get to it. But Group Genius, and one of the examples he uses in his discussion of group flow is improv. And that's sort of – so he goes over jazz. He goes over pickup basketball and then improv. So I'd love to hear more about if you could get into sort of that sensory experience from your perspective. Like you go up as a group, you're performing, and you're nailing it. What's that like?
So the – Group Genius by Keith Sawyer.
Keith Sawyer, yeah.
And you know who wrote the first quote of reviewing the book? Mike Csikszentmihalyi.
Yeah.
In a fascinating account of human experience at its best. So shout out Keith Sawyer.
Yeah.
You're a sponsor for the day.
Yeah.
What does it feel like to experience this group flow of all of this optimal collaboration in improv? It relies on trust.
Mm.
It's crazy how much trust is needed for that. And I think in an audience, when you're dancing, let's say, you can feel group flow because you don't really need that personal contact with an intellectual contact with people. It's more of a bodily contact. So there is a physical trust going on. Yeah. And in improv, there's this intellectual trust that I'm not trying to be funny. That's like a one axiom of improv. Mm. Don't try to be funny.
Yeah.
The goal is to set the other person up to be funny.
Interesting.
And say what is truthful, because what is truthful and what's honest is what is often most funny. The big belly laughs that happen during comedy are not from the slapsticks or the puns, which are funny. We'll get some giggles. We'll get some little nose, little nose laughs, right? But the big belly laughs are that true human experience of failure, of sadness, of longing, of love, of hurt. That requires a sense of trust between two people that I know this person has my back. Hmm. And when that happens, when we have each other's backs, it's a famous improv saying, I got your back, bro.
Yeah.
When that happens, it's like an athletic experience where you're just talking and and you feel that like ultimate – it's really – I lose myself.
Yeah.
It is a flow experience. I lose myself and I'm just talking and I'm in this character and I'm just talking and I'm having fun. It's a playground.
I think you said play, and that's a huge part of it. So playing basketball, you know, you're playing literally, right? It's a game. That's what it is. And it's similar. You know, you mentioned trust, and I guess I hadn't fully considered that, but there is that aspect of trust. And one of the most prominent memories in really my athletic career was in college. We were playing Williams and Mary my senior year, and we had a really good team. We were an incredibly cohesive group, a beautiful blend of really different individuals that we all accepted each other and accepted each other's weirdness. So I think that, you know, that contributed to that trust. So we were playing Williams and Mary, and we were locked in going into the game. We were similar rankings, so we had a huge chip on our shoulder all season. So we went in there, and we felt really connected. At the end of the first half, the score was 40-5.
Whew.
40-5. So holding a Division I college team to 5 points and a half is not an easy task. And what happened was defensively, we connected in a way where it was almost an extrasensory experience where we were so connected as a unit that I knew if I forced my man baseline, the help side was coming, that another guy would drop down, cover him, that two rotations would be there. And, that I think that baseline of trust was so strong and firm that allowed this, you know, this complete creativity to occur and this spontaneity, right, and innovation in an instant to happen. And it was one of those moments, you probably had this with improv too, where it ends and you're just like, what just – you know,
what just happened?
What just happened, man? Like, what time is it? I mean, do I need to eat? I don't know what's going on. Am I in my body? I don't know.
The way you explained it made me feel like you guys were all one hand.
Yeah.
And you were a finger on each of those hands, and you were orchestrating with one another. Do you think the fingers are aware of that they're connected to each finger? You know what I mean? Like, we're not really connected physically to each other. We've all had experiences when things just happen so seamless. It's as if we're all working in coherence, in harmony.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, what we just talked about and just coming back to positive psych and as a whole, it's, I think, you know, mindfulness and group flow are two examples of what, you know, I think the ethos of positive psychology, right? Like, how do we, taking these human experiences that occur in these optimal states and being able to define them, study them, break them down so that we can increase the frequency of occurrence, for the betterment of humanity. Do you mind, Jason, because I think it's a really cool story, talking a little bit about sort of the origin story of pause psych?
Well, most of psychology research has been examining what goes wrong with life. That's like the sentiment. Since William James's time of one of the fathers of psychology, we've always looked at and used patients that had poor mental health and used them in studies to understand the neuroses of the human mind. And then once we understand the neuroses, I mean, we work backwards to help heal people. Positive psychology was born with the intention of understanding, well, what goes right in life? What does good development look like? And let's even out the playing field just to understand things within a realm of growth and connection instead of just survival, mental health, getting people from 0 to 10 instead of just -10 to 0. The story begins with Martin Seligman, who was the APA, American Psychology Association president, heading into it, his presidency, I think it was 1999 maybe. He was going on vacation with his wife beforehand, before entering the presidency. And just by happen chance, on the same, you know, some sort of Bahama island, ran into Mike Csikszentmihalyi, who's a renowned psychologist who's examining flow at the time, not under the guise of positive psychology, but just to understand optimal experience, creativity within things from rock climbing to painting, sports, work, all of it. And they had a fruitful discussion about, okay, where should psychology go? And they came up from that discussion of just pure chance, they came up with a discussion that psychology needs to even out to understand what goes right in life. And so after this, you know, magical kind of happen chance that they met each other, they formed a little group of psychologists, primarily in the States, I believe, and some European psychologists. And they went to, I think it's called Anaku. It's like the Anaku consortium or something. And they all met together to discuss, okay, what is this new discipline of psychology going to look like? And they organized some goals and some strategies. And we had people like Barbara Fredrickson, who was going to look at some positive emotions, brought in a Bill theory. We have all sorts of different people coming together and just boosted this new discipline of positive psychology, which is not only looking at, right, positive unicorns and rainbows. It's right. Just looking at what is growth and connection.
Right.
So even post-traumatic growth, which is this idea that's in life, some of the biggest moments of growth in people's lives originated from a moment of struggle and trauma.
Yeah.
So what made some people grow from their traumatic experiences and what made people still locked in, frozen, either frozen in time or they're just always active and they can't control themselves? What differentiates those people might be this growth factor.
Yeah. Well, that's well put. And I love that story. First of all, I love the idea of Mike and Martin walking on the beach, you know, pants rolled up probably.
Yeah.
Maybe, you know, shirts unbuttoned in a casual way.
In a casual
way. Just, yeah, still professional, but, you know, they're living life. And that sort of spontaneous origin, I think really speaks to the purpose and the intention behind positive psych. And I think also you made a great distinction that it's not all, you know, I think the positive side could be misleading at times in that that's a sole focus, right? I think that's more of the goal is to, regardless of where you are, to be able to say that this is a possibility, right? It's possible to live life and maintain a positive outlook and a positive perspective, regardless of the circumstances, but not to diminish, you know, the value that traumatic experiences or challenges could have in one's own development. I know for me personally, it's gotten to a point where, you know, when a challenge comes up, it's still uncomfortable. It's like, you know, you want to like give it a stiff arm, keep it away. Yeah. Like, you're still there. Okay. Well,
a good distance. Let me keep it a good distance away. Just stiff arm it and keep my hand there.
Yeah.
And then it starts to shake a little bit. Oh.
Yeah. And I think it's when you know, what positive psych gives you is the necessary internal resources and tools to take your hand off, to embrace the challenge and have the confidence that, you know what, we can work with this. We can work through this and and grow and learn in some capacity, in some way.
I mean, that's such a relieving idea to not need to keep pushing things away that are uncomfortable and deeming them as bad.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? I mean, to let your arms go and deal with things and see many experiences and opportunities as value added.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's something I'm wondering as you study, you know, because it's interesting. There's sort of this two experiences. You're studying from an academic sense, right? Where you're reading all these papers, you're having to cite every other sentence, and it becomes somewhat mechanical in a sense, or it can be at least. So how do you balance sort of the academic rigor that's required in order to further research and further the field with actually embodying and living these principles?
Yeah, I mean, reading so much just activates that conceptual mind.
Yeah.
Loves the digits and the numbers, and this goes in this box and that goes in this box. Oh. And now those boxes are separate and it makes sense and I feel good. The problem is that just the intellectual mind is not the only mind, so to speak. This is not super jargony, but we can think of it as like you can't just please that intellectual mind that wants to make concepts and variables and understand models. We have this other part of us. I like the idea of the soul man is kind of what I call it to myself, at least. This is not academic jargon, by the way. The soul. I need to unleash the soul man. It has to be free. It has to play. How do I balance those things out? Well, when I first came here, I was like, oh, I can just study this and then I'll achieve optimal performance all the time. That's the way to do this. And I slowly discovered that's not the case.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's not a ridiculous claim to say that like nobody has ever read one self-help book and then suddenly gotten enlightened.
Yeah.
And so it requires like action and experience. For me, sports.
Yeah.
I think I have like fulfilling disciplines is what I call them, where I need to cultivate practice and play. So sports, whether it's like for me right now, volleyball, playing spike ball, it's a great beach game. And then also music, playing guitar, doing some comedy, whether it's stand-up or improv, a lot of movement stuff, and then my mindfulness practice.
So when you're playing volleyball, for example, how are you – you know, how are you taking some of the material that you've been learning about, and what does it look like when you're actually integrating that into your play?
Ooh, yeah, great question. I want to hear your ideas too, because it's good to learn about how I can better apply it. Because it's easy to like just like turn the page and like go forward, right? And just forget everything that we were learning. But the one, I think for me, I just will ground myself. I always ground myself during play to not get in my head too often. Because I think especially PhD students or graduate students in general, we would love to get caught in the mind and think. And if I think enough, I'll solve the problem.
Yeah, yeah.
If I can just think for a little bit longer, I'll solve it. No. So to kind of just go into my feet.
Yeah.
What am I feeling right now in my feet? What am I feeling right now in the air? What am I listening? What am I hearing? Just think. Just only think about the stimulation coming in. That helps me get away from always trying to problem solve and into just my body.
Yeah. I think that's that point cannot be emphasized enough, right? Like, you know, for me, coming from a time in my life where I spent the majority of my day in my body, whether it was training, playing, or you know, just different workouts. I remember my first month here, I had a headache for about the entire month.
And the body just has nonstop information.
Yeah.
The body gives information.
But it was like this muscle of my brain had not been worked. And I noticed that, you know, throughout this process, I've spent just in order to keep up with everything that's required. Like now, for example, I have an imbalance where I've been doing so much work. I'm up here in my head and needing to spend more time in my body. But for, you know, I think bringing your awareness to your feet is it's such an easy, quick reframe and shift of perspective. Your feet are the farthest, you know, part of your body from your head. So immediately it just draws your attention and your awareness away from your mind and your brain. And even you can even notice in yourself, like there's some signals, like your voice will drop in tone, your speech may slow. You know, there's all these signals that are letting you know, okay, this is what being in my body's like.
And it can be done anytime.
Anytime.
And it's
I'm doing it right now.
I'm doing it right now too, man. Yeah. And you can't even notice it.
You don't even know.
Yeah. What's so crazy about it is like it doesn't require that much cognitive resources to do. And it shows that also listening, for instance, is effortless.
Yeah.
I can be putting my attention into my feet and just kind of experience that, and I can still listen perfectly fine.
And you may even listen better, right? Because
maybe even better.
You're not trying to process or come up with the next, you know, rebuttal or comment to the phrase. You're just allowing it to occur naturally. And I think you're able to take in more information. You know, there's this idea of the unconscious, for example, right? Where it's why practices like hypnosis, and there's all these different techniques where you're trying, like, I don't know if have you ever tried speed reading?
Yes. Oh, yeah, man. Yeah. I bought a couple of books on that. Yeah, really tried.
Right. It's an interesting theory, though. This idea that when you sort of move away from the conscious mind or try to bypass it, you're able to absorb way more information. And I think now with neuroscience, there will be some interesting research coming out about the capacity of that.
Speed reading, real quick.
Yeah.
I haven't talked about that in years. Yeah, that's so funny to bring it up. Because it's more similar to watching TV than it is reading. Because reading, we're usually trying to think for each word. And sometimes we can tap into it where we flow easily.
Yeah.
And with speed reading, you're trying to capture more words per movement of the eye. Because our eyes, actually, you can close your eyes and you can look around and you notice it's not a smooth movement. It's actually chunks.
Yeah, yeah.
Speed reading is quite interesting.
It is.
Yeah.
I have a quick story about that. So I got into it in college, and I had to take a summer course to graduate. I had a really awesome professor who gave me the project was reading dystopian novels.
Hmm.
So nice. I really enjoyed so I was reading 1984, and I wanted to test speed reading out. I sped read the book, which, you know, as you mentioned, it's scanning the lines rapidly, and in the process I used also was simply flipping pages with you're sort of adjusting your vision, so you're becoming aware of your peripherals, so you're able to not really focusing on anything in particular, but being able to see more, taking more of your environment than you normally would. So I did that about 15 minutes, and I had a meeting with my professor next day. We were going to talk about the book. And it was interesting. I wasn't able to grasp the details. You know, if you would drill down into what did you think about this character, you know, or this situation. But overall, I was able to talk about general themes. So like there was this overall, I guess, conceptual understanding that, I don't know, you know, 1984 is a pretty famous book, so people talk about it. So it could have been that too. But there was this subtle awareness that there was some information there.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, for me, that was just like, wow, okay, noted.
It's a practice, too. If people did it for months at a time, they get way better and it can up their comprehension along with their quickness.
Yeah.
It can be done. It does take work. It's not like something that can be done super, you know.
Yeah, don't try that on your next
Don't try
exam.
It at home, kids. Yeah. Yeah. No. So what are some practices that you do to implement into your flow activities?
Yeah. So in sports, you know, I use it. I still play basketball and train. I really enjoy hiking and trail running as well. I mean, just, you know, get a ball, any ball. Big fan of just playing, right? So Frisbee. What I try to do is similar to in just grounding myself, letting go of needing to do anything, trying to be present in the moment. And some ways I do that is I'll try to, before I do any sort of activity, just become aware of my breath and become aware of my feet and my lower belly. You know, it's in Taoism, the Dantian. So that sort of that grounding force inside. And then when I'm performing, I practice positive self-talk. So being able to communicate with myself internally. And for me, it's sort of this quest of being able to, how much mastery or control do I have over my environment? Mm. So if I tell myself, for example, playing basketball, like, okay, I'm going to go by this guy and I'm going to score. And if I can speak that with conviction and then I believe that statement and I'm able to enact it, to me, I see that as like, okay, that's a manifestation point, right? And I think that skill set of being able to command yourself and be able to interact in an external context is an interesting way to play with your own ability to do what you want to do, in a sense, to put it like very simply. So I like to play with that, and in volleyball too. You know, Jason and I play volleyball, and he's far superior skill wise. So I really like doing things that I'm not very good at or don't have a lot of experience in, because then you have that beginner's mind, right? Mm. And you're like a child, where it's like you can approach it and everything is new. So your trajectory of development is can be really steep. So for example, something like basketball, having played so long, in order to advance skill-wise takes so much effort, and the skills I'm developing, you know, a lot of people wouldn't even notice. I'm aware of it, but, you know, like increasing your 3-point percentage from 38 to 42, that takes a lot of work, right? And it's a small growth. Whereas in volleyball, you know, being able to not hit a hit out of bounds every time, you know, is like I can see tangible results really quickly.
Immediately. Yeah. Yeah, when I was training for my half marathon last summer, it was like I'm not a big runner. Well, now I'm much better, but back then it was like I never ran more than 3.5-4 miles before. And what was cool about that was, because the bar was so low, every single run was a personal record.
Yeah.
And I love this idea of every new activity is a PR.
Yeah.
PR here, PR there. And so it was like, oh, 5 miles, PR. Personal record.
Yeah.
6 miles, PR. Yeah. 8, you know, and it just kept going. And it's so fulfilling to start very low and have a low expectation on myself, a low threshold for what success is, a low threshold for what's good enough to be worthy of celebrating.
And how did those PRs, how did those translate into other domains of your life? That experience of achieving those PRs, let's say you go out and you run 6 miles for the first time. You go back and you start working. You know, what's that experience like?
There's a less judgment and less need to be, quote unquote, the best I can be, because I just gave my all in another domain.
You just got to win.
And so it's kind of like, oh, the expectation's gone. I can just kind of be now. And that's why I love working out in the morning, because I can – or doing one specific big important task to myself, whether it's a chore – or writing a paper or something, because one thing I can get done and it's like, oh, at least I did that today.
Yeah.
And I think a big problem that I see within people who work, and this is mainly from my own experience, is that I will just judge myself for not doing enough, not getting enough done, even if I get like 30 things on my task list done.
Yeah. Those task lists, man. I mean, I wrote one today, far too long. Right? But yeah, I think that's a really good point. And I have this phrase that I talk to self-talk again, is win the day. So sort of setting an expectation or an intention for the day, like what would be a win? And this is probably from my athletic background, but and it could be as simple as, you know, getting a morning workout in. You already won, right? You won the day. Everything else is bonus from there. Or having those, like, you know, being able to drill down to what would you lay, you know, future pace yourself to your laying in bed at night. What are you going to feel good about? Mm. How could you sleep and feel fulfilled? And if you can do those, you know, everything else is a bonus.
And make it essential. Make it small. Make it narrow. Like, I love this for my task list. It's like, what are my big three of the day?
Nice. Yeah.
And sometimes I just put big two now, because it's like the more narrow I get, the better I can get deeper on that couple of tasks that I need to do. And a note on like positive self-talk or positive affirmations, which people tend to be kind of allergic to that word, right? Because it's kind of like gooey.
Yeah.
And there is some research to suggest that when we do have an affirmation that's more of a quality, like, oh, I am rich, for instance. Yet when I have evidence pointing to the fact that I'm not rich, that can be discouraging and it can cause a lot of internal struggle. So a way to utilize any sort of positive self-talk or affirmation is to add the words may I to it, and it had to be an action. So may I be wealthy? May I practice kindness? Now you're kind of asking, you're kind of acknowledging a wish, an intention that doesn't have to be absolutely apparent, like I have $1 million. Yeah, there's my, my bank account may say otherwise, or I have so many friends, and just repeating those mantras can be kind of harmful. But if you say, may I be blank, it's a good way to kind of nudge yourself into an intention.
Yeah, I could see that taking the pressure off too.
Yeah.
So you're not checking your bank account. What? Where's the million?
I've said the affirmations 15 times a day.
Yeah.
I crossed it off my checklist, on my task list.
It's been a week. It should be here. Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, that's just, I think what we're talking, you know, that's just a reference to this huge garage full of positive psych tools that can be used. And I think one, you know, what we touched on with sports is finding time for these activities where that offer something that maybe our life at work doesn't, or offering a different perspective and a different way to interact with others, with ourselves, with the world around us.
It's active leisure.
Yes.
And there's passive leisure, and true enjoyment requires a level of effort though.
Yeah.
And so, you know, binge watching The Office, it's great. I love it. I've watched that series twice, I'll be honest with you. But it's more meaningful and a greater depth of enjoyment when I do some sort of active leisure that requires effort.
Yeah.
That's not just sitting there.
Yeah. And I think that goes back to, you know, attention you touched on earlier. And one of the, probably the, you know, the most impactful statements I heard at CGU was when in Positive Foundation. So the first class we take here, where Mike Csikszentmihalyi gave a presentation and basically broke down how many hours we have to live. And then took the hours, which I think was, you know, around, I think in a typical life age range between 70 and 80, you know, had a certain amount of hours. And then you divide that, you know, you take 2/3 of that, that's how long you're awake, right? And then you take another third away, and that's how much time you spend at work. So you're left with 1/3 of your waking life, and that's what you got.
So we got about 8,760 hours in 1 year.
Yeah.
Okay, and so you're saying that 1/3 of that,
yeah,
is probably asleep?
Yeah.
Right, it's 24, so like 8 out of 16?
Yeah.
On average?
Yeah. And for me, that's just reframed. And this was all in the context of emphasizing the importance of our attention. And what the question becomes, what are you going to do with your attention? Because attention is the most valuable resource we have.
And it's one of them. And it's not the only valuable resource that we individually have, but other people want.
Yes.
And you know what? There are teams of MIT graduates all trying to figure out, how do we steal your attention? And if I don't manage it, that group of MIT people, they will get it.
Yeah.
So I ran the numbers.
Yeah.
Ran the numbers.
Hear
it. Our StatCast group actually ran the numbers that we have over in the corner. 2,920 hours in a year that are awake. That also includes going to the bathroom, eating food, right? But that's awake, assuming we have an 8-hour sleep. 90 years old is pretty accurate. We'll probably live that long.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, 262,800 hours. That's it.
That's it.
How do you want to choose each one of those? We have a choice. As Viktor Frankl, one of the a famous book that has been pretty much categorized within the positive psychology realm, is Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl, a Holocaust survivor. It's about his experiences during the Holocaust. He says a great quote, between stimulus and response is a space. And in that space, there is a choice. how do we want to place our attention pretty much in that space. There are ways to widen that space if you so choose to learn those Jedi trick techniques. But we do have a choice most of the time. And having that intention will make a life well lived.
Yeah. I think that sums it up.
Can we do a lightning round real quick?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, so what has been your flow recently, last week? What has been a flow activity for you?
Flow activity.
How have you prioritized any flow? Now, we all have ebbs and flows, pun intended, where we go through weeks where it's tough to find a moment. You know, it could even be, I went into bed and it was nice. That could be it. Yeah. Get under covers and just feel good, you know? Treat yourself to maybe a little Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Half-baked is my favorite. Or it could be like actually a huge trail hike. So yeah, what has been your flow of the week?
So it's NBA playoff season. Big basketball fan. Shout out to the Portland Trailblazers right now. Teammate CJ McCollum doing his thing. So my flow has been watching basketball and while working out. So I'll watch the game. And I have a BOSU ball in my room, so I'll be doing different activities while I'm playing. And in commercials, I'm doing like a lightning workout round. So I'll do push-ups, planks, just different movements to activate my body. And I find that really I'm able to engage the game probably at times, maybe a little too much so. Got some noise complaints from roommates. But you know, I think that's been helpful for me. We're getting gearing up towards finals, so you could say the temperature is being turned up in terms of the
sauna temps,
the workload. Yeah, for sure. So that's been something I've been doing. What about you?
For me, I'm gonna give a switch up and say for me, my flow of the week has been just having late night conversations with roomies.
Nice
to have that in that space to just talk. It's in free flow and not necessarily vent. I got to be careful about venting, right? That's just spewing negative energy onto other people. Yeah. But really just to explore and talk and say what's up. And it's something that I've continuously been appreciative of, to have people that I really enjoy living with and to have those random sporadic conversations that I never planned. I didn't plan to sit down and have a podcast with them.
Yeah.
But it turns out to be this great conversation that's meaningful, that we jam on, that becomes a flow activity.
Group flow?
Like a group flow activity, full circle.
Yeah. So that's your flow. Love the flow. What about a challenge? Weekly challenge.
Challenge of the week for me has been definitely using the daytime hours the best that I can. I tend to kind of go slow in the morning, which I like, because it helps me kind of get into my day softly. So I wake up 2 hours at least before having to do anything. So I have that time to have my morning rituals. But what has happened is that spilled over to the rest of the day, where I kind of go slow and I don't have a good intention about certain work sessions. And that's been a challenge because it requires me to stay longer and work longer than I intended for. And I like to utilize the time that I've given and make sure I take things seriously. Playful, but take my attention seriously. So that's been my challenge. How about you?
Yeah. For me, it's been work-life balance, specifically managing relationships. So being able to do what I need to do in terms of work, but at the same time prioritize meaningful relationships for me. And, you know, when there's a lot to get done, sometimes we can lose sight of how valuable those relationships are and how meaningful, and then in the sort of the respect and the energy that's required to give the other individual or other individuals, to honor them in the way that they deserve. And some point in this podcast, we'll definitely talk about relationships as positive relationships.
High quality.
Yes.
Relationships and high quality connections.
Absolutely. Well, that's what we got today. Thank you all for tuning in. We really enjoyed this process. I'll speak for both of us. Really enjoyed this process.
Yeah, definitely enjoyed it.
And we look forward to diving into some more topics in the near future. So from Studio B3 at Claremont Graduate University, this is the
About Being Alive
podcast, and we are signing off. See ya.